items, 11-31-29.
Please the court.
My name is Bo Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant, Kellett Williams. Kellett Williams appeals to this court following the district court's denial of his motion to suppress evidence based on a Franks violation. The issue, or the portion of the argument I'd like to address first, is that the court committed clear error by not finding that Officer Dean Corbis acted intentionally or with reckless disregard for the truth when he failed to truthfully and accurately identify the sources of information he obtained about what the informant in this case, Andre Bell, said. Very plainly in his affidavit in support of the warrant, Dean Corbis wrote, "I, Dean Corbis, met an individual who wants to cooperate with the police. In conversation with individual, the following facts were related to me." And then Dean Corbis wrote out in first person as quotes the things that he was alleging that he heard from Mr. Bell. And when he did that, it's plain from the meaning of that, the way that it's written, the only plain meaning is that he interviewed Bell, and Bell told him these explicit things that he's saying in first person. It's like he's sort of like a stenographer. I took these things down accurately. This is what Bell told me. What's missing here is any indication that Bell was arrested as part of a larger investigation involving other officers. What's missing here is any assertion that any other officers were involved in the conversation with Bell or the obtainment of information from Bell.
Because he was in the room when he was interviewed and he provided this information.
I want to make sure I understand your question. Officer Corbis was in the office where this was going on, is what the testimony was at the hearing. Officer Corbis admitted at the hearing that he did not hear the things that Bell said. He admitted that he didn't participate in the interview. He admitted all information was given to him by law enforcement officers after they had done the interview.
Oh, this is at the magistrate's hearing you're talking about?
This was before the district court at the suppression hearing.
Okay, what about the magistrate?
We have no record whatsoever of what the magistrate said or who went before the magistrate. If you look at the record from the suppression hearing, Dean Corbis does not recall ever going to the magistrate, although the affidavit suggests that's what's going to happen. Andre Bell remembers going and meeting some guy, but he doesn't know who.
Is there some question whether the Bell was before the magistrate?
Agent Labneau testified that Bell went before the magistrate, and it looks like that's what happened based on the affidavit that says they're going to present him to the magistrate, but Bell doesn't remember necessarily going, and Corbis doesn't remember going, and Agent Labneau did not give any testimony indicated that he knew who went, only that somebody had gone with Bell to the magistrate.
Was this the park bench meeting?
This is the park bench meeting, yes. And I think the vital thing here that separates this case from Kirk and Spears, which are the cases that the government was citing, was in both Kirk and Spears, the affiant specifically said multiple officers are involved in this from the beginning. He sets forth that there's multiple officers involved and this is a large investigation. That happened in both Kirk and Spears. So it was reasonable to assume some of the information could come from those officers. The problem here is that this case has not any indication of that.
Mr. Brindley?
Yes.
Did the district court actually make a finding that Corbis had just made an honest mistake, or is it silent?
The district court's opinion is very unclear as to what mistakes there are. The district court says there are mistakes, plural. And the district court says it's because of communication errors between the officers and agents. Now, if there are communication errors here, then Officer Corbis did not truthfully reflect the information because there's nobody to communicate with, according to what he wrote. And there's no way, logically speaking, you can write this information was related to me in an interview with this person, which is the plain meaning of what he wrote, and then set forth the quotes you say you heard like you're a stenographer taking it down for accuracy, if you know that you didn't participate in that, that you didn't talk to him, that it all came from someone else. This is just like Davis, where it's logically impossible to say this wasn't intentional. It has to be. You can't do that without doing it on purpose. Why Officer Corbis did it, if he thinks you have to write it up this way, if this is his, I don't know. But it doesn't matter. As a matter of logic, the way he wrote it means that it has to be either intentional or with reckless disregard of the truth, as Davis found.
Mr. Brindley, let me ask you, one of the things that concerns me on your side of the case is that at least at the time this application was presented, the police had what certainly looks like very solid probable cause based on the recorded phone call with Mr. Williams from that afternoon. The gun is there. The drugs are there. You can pick them up in 45 minutes or an hour and a half. That was not presented to the magistrate. If it had been, there's no doubt a warrant would have been provided. And that certainly seems to speak in favor of good faith on the part of the officers.
Well, Your Honor, I think that obviously that would have been the case. If they'd written it up that way, then that's true. Just as in Davis, when the Davis court said if they wrote it and explained where this information was coming from correctly, that wouldn't have been a problem. But they didn't do that. We can't talk about, we're limited to the four corners of this application.
Well, no, we're not when we're evaluating intent.
Certainly, but the intent that's relevant here is the affiant, whether he's the one that's writing it up and whether he's intentionally doing it. There's no way, logically speaking, you could think that Dean Corbis, knowing that he didn't participate in this interview and writing that he talked to this person and the information was related to him, the following was related to me, and not indicating anything about anybody else participating, he has to know that's misleading. There's no way you can't. Logically speaking, it's impossible. So I think, just as in Davis, well, there is a better way to do it that would save it. And I agree with that. I don't know what was wrong with Dean Corbis. Perhaps the problem is they allowed an officer with no knowledge to start writing this up. And he did it in a way that had reckless disregard for the truth because he didn't know what to do or what the information was. But regardless, you can't save it that way. It has to be intentional or with reckless disregard as a matter of logic. Taking him before the magistrate, Mr. Bell, doesn't save it either. And I think that's important. We can't have officers making statements that have to be intentionally wrong or with reckless disregard for the truth and saying we can clean it up every time we just take one of the sources for the information to the magistrate. And the Franks analysis doesn't allow for that to be an exception.
But one of the other problems you have here is the CI statement, which is very detailed in terms of what was there. So there's certainly enough probable cause in his statement to stand.
It would be if that statement could remain in. But if what Officer Corbis says is, these are the statements that were related to me, and then he includes them, that's one statement. The quotations from Bell are a part of Corbis's statement. This is what Bell told me. You can't leave those statements in because that's part of the false statement that Corbis is presenting. That's part of the misleading portion of this affidavit, is to say, I heard these things, and write them down as first-person quotations suggesting their accuracy and giving the magistrate no reason to question that and no reason to question the layers of hearsay that he doesn't know about between Corbis and the information. And there were multiple layers. We don't know how many based on the record. But the Franks analysis says, is there a false statement, and was it intentional or made with reckless disregard for the truth? And I think we established that in that case. So that's the first prong. Going to the magistrate can have no bearing on that. It either is or it isn't. And then the next thing you do is you have to strike out the false statement. Taking to the magistrate has no bearing on that. You have to do that. That's what Frank says. And once we've established this fact about Corbis, all of the information that he's saying was provided to him, he's saying that inaccurately and in a misleading way, just as they did in Davis.
Did Bell see the affidavit?
Bell said he signed something, but he doesn't know what, and he didn't read it.
So he signed the affidavit, but he didn't read it.
He doesn't. It's unclear whether he did. I think he did. But he says he specifically didn't read it. There's no evidence that Corbis ever saw him with it or that Corbis was the one who was with him. There's no evidence in the record to suggest how that happened or how accurate that was. What we know is that it's a false statement, and when you strike it out, there is not enough left to save the warrant. And with
Could I ask you, Mr. Brindley, to address the district court's analysis, in essence indicating that judges in Chicago in the state court should know that if somebody brings an informant in front of them, he has not, I think, recently left the role of altar boy, was the way the judge put it.
Yeah.
And but they ought to just assume that the person is under arrest, motivated to lie, et cetera, et cetera.
If I could have a moment to answer that question, despite the time. I think that the answer to that question is they may be able to make an assumption that he's under some sort of arrest. The problem here was the omission was what kind of arrest. What we knew from the facts in the application was that this was a marijuana customer of Mr. Williams, is what Bells was saying. So the idea the magistrate could have is, well, this guy's just a small-time marijuana purchaser. What the magistrate was not told was this guy was in trouble for firearms crimes, multiple firearms, illegal firearms selling, and that's a much more serious crime that gives much more serious incentives. And by denying him that, they denied him the ability to ask the important questions and evaluate Mr. Bell in a credible way. And for those reasons, we would ask that the district court decision be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Mr. Shakeshaw.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Tom Shakeshaw from the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Chicago on behalf of the United States. Following the Franks hearing in this case, the district court correctly found that the officers and agents involved did not intentionally or with reckless disregard mislead the state court judge who issued the warrant in this case, and he properly denied the motion. The inaccuracy in the search warrant that counsel points to, the statement that Officer Corbis' statement that Bell had related to him certain facts, was immaterial to the state court judge's probable cause determination. The middle paragraph of that warrant, which contained the substance of the criminal allegations, was a first-person narrative that was attributed to Andre Bell. It disclosed the source of the information, the John Doe, Andre Bell. It was signed by Bell, and to your point, Judge Mannion, there is evidence in the record. If you look at the warrant itself, it is signed by John Doe. At the hearing, Andre Bell said, "That looks like my signature." It's signed by the state court judge, and there was testimony at the hearing that Andre Bell and Officer Corbis were, in fact, and keep in mind that this all happened in the course of about 3 hours and 10 minutes on Good Friday in 2004, they were able to get Judge Sheehan, a state court judge, to go to a park bench on the south side of Chicago to swear this out. Bell appeared personally. Bell remembered that he didn't know that it was a judge. He was in a park. But he remembered that he'd been asked questions. There is no record, counsel is correct, of that, of what occurred. But the affidavit, I think, on its face shows, and there was never an allegation that this was somehow fraudulent. Bell was brought before the state court judge on a park bench at about 5 o'clock.
Well, what about Mr. Brindley's argument that it would be hard for Judge Sheehan to evaluate Bell's credibility when he wasn't provided with complete information in the warrant application or about Bell's background?
I guess my answer to that is Judge Zagel got a chance the individual was brought before the judge. If you observe Mr. Bell, I think Judge Zagel got it right. He was not, he didn't resign his job as altar boy to be brought before a state court judge in a big hurry late in the afternoon.
Well, look, we don't expect state judges to be naive, but don't they have a reasonable right to expect that the officers will provide relevant information about that credibility?
Of course.
Like the fact that he's under arrest and facing serious charges and that he's gotten the dates wrong and inconsistent in his stories?
We're certainly not excusing sloppy affidavit drafting.
I think that's what you're asking us to do.
No, I think that what we're asking to do is to read the statement that Bell provided as to the...
That's not... No. There's no doubt that if Bell comes before a judge, says all that, and the judge believes him, that's probable cause. nor, and there's also no doubt that if you provide the information from the telephone call, there's probable cause. But neither of those things is what happened. And because what's not disclosed to the judge are the reasons to be skeptical about Bell's reliability.
It is true that the fact that he was under arrest was not in the affidavit. And whether it be oversight or a matter of timing.
Well, in fact, nothing that might tend to undermine Bell's credibility is in the affidavit, right?
Well, unless it lays out that he's had an ongoing six-year marijuana relationship with the subject of the search warrant. So it indicates he is a criminal. It indicates that he had seen firearms.
He could be buying for himself, though, right?
True enough, but he's talking about his source of supply. So we're talking about, you know, as is often the case in these cases, a either a criminal as a CI or a in this case, a criminal defendant who's trying to work off his case, giving information to the officers who included in the warrant. I no doubt a better drafted affidavit, given more time, would have included that.
Could you address Judge Castillo's reasoning in the Simmons case, which has a lot of similarities to this, and he granted a motion to suppress where, in essence, saying even if you could, you might have been able to get a good search warrant for this. If you present this kind of just sanitized version of the CI, it's hard to see those admissions as accidental. And that these go really to the heart of the integrity of the search warrant process.
Well, I guess the answer to that is twofold. One is that, and I'm not arguing that taking the CI to the judge always cures the defect, but in this instance, where our argument is that the John Doe allegations, the statements within that paragraph, are sufficient to establish probable cause as to the location that was going to be searched. The bringing of the defendant to the judge does put the judge on notice that this person is in custody.
Was he in handcuffs?
That I don't know. I don't think there's any testimony in the record about that. That paragraph was sufficient to put the judge on notice that, and bringing him to the judge that. The defendant, I don't know, was in custody. He was accompanied by police officers. I think it's a reasonable inference that the judge knew that he was cooperating for a reason. I'd like to just touch on a couple of the issues I think one of the important things about counsel's argument is that he has attempted to take the fact that Corbis said that these facts were related to me, and that therefore makes the entire rest of the affidavit false. I don't think that logically follows. That misstatement or inaccuracy was not included for the purpose of securing the warrant.
Well, doesn't it have the effect, though, of in essence insulating Lambro or others who actually talked to Bell from being questioned about the information?
I don't know that it insulates them. A logical reading of this affidavit is that this is Bell's statement. And, I mean, Judge Zagel found that there was no recklessness or intent to mislead the judge here, the state court judge who issued the warrant. And then, even though he found that, where he doesn't have to, I mean, under these court's precedents, once the district court finds that it was negligent as opposed to reckless or intentional.
How could Corbis's statement have been negligent?
It could have been negligent in the sense that he said this was related to me as a matter of practice. I don't know that he was intentional. I guess the way I would look at it is it doesn't get him anywhere to fabricate that. It was drafted as a John Doe warrant where the John Doe was taken before the judge. Who it was related to, and as the district court found, the one thing that came out of this hearing was this was not a warrant that was issued on the representation of a police officer. That is, as we acknowledge in our brief, an inartfully drafted affidavit. But unlike Davis that Mr. Brindley relies on, in that case, there was a, I think, a DEA supervisor who essentially adopted what his group had told him as a first-person narrative that it had been told to him, and that's what the Ninth Circuit had a hard time with, was it did not accurately disclose to the issuing magistrate who the true source of information was. That's not the case here. This does disclose the true source of information because it's drafted as a first-person affidavit for the CI himself, which he himself signed in the presence of the judge. So Officer Corbis doesn't get anywhere if the idea is that he was intentionally misleading the court for in an effort to obtain the warrant. It doesn't get him anywhere.
Was he a supervisor of any kind?
No, I mean, he's just a, as far as I know, he's a run-of-the-mill Chicago police officer who happened to be working with ATF on the day in question. Very briefly, as to the omissions, a good part of this, the testimony at the Franks hearing revolved around the date that Mr. Bell had given. Both Agent Labneau and Bell himself said that during the course of what was an abbreviated period of time, Bell gave inconsistent dates as to when he was last. And even if one undertook the Franks analysis and substituted 3 or 4 days before as opposed to the day before, I mean, Agent Labneau testified he was not attempting to freshen up PC. The Bell's affidavit was an accurate recitation of what he had said, although he had said inconsistent things. The question we've addressed about him being in custody, the district court found that the fact that Bell was brought before the state court judge obviated many of those concerns.
In your brief, you described this as Bell had given agents slightly inconsistent statements regarding when he was last in Williams' apartment. 5 days earlier, the day before. You see that as a slight inconsistency?
If I may respond to the question.
Yes, certainly.
I do. If you look at, and we cited it to the district court, I mean, the timing of probable cause, the timing of the freshness is obviously relevant.
I'm trying to imagine how you would approach a defense alibi witness, for example, who couldn't tell the difference between what had happened the day before and 5 days earlier in cross-examining him.
I don't disagree, but the point is that Bell did say both things and acknowledged at the hearing he had said both things.
And why not tell the judge?
And the same reason, if we could have, I would have asked the agents to put the phone call in. I would have asked the agent to be, they didn't have the time. Bell put them on a time frame unwittingly by talking to Williams in California and told him that we'll be there in 45 to 90 minutes. And it was, frankly, you know, I would have preferred they put a lot of things in, but at the same token, I'm glad that I'm here defending what they did do as opposed to defending their decision that these were exigent circumstances. They actually did go get the warrant and tried to do it the right way.
So you think it would have been hard to put in the second date in his little statement, first-person statement?
Agent Labneau, if you look at the record, Agent Labneau said that he originally said he was there 3 or 4 days earlier. Agent Labneau continued to press him on when he was last there because their ATF's concern was, is he lying about when he was there? Was he actually there more recently? Because they don't want them to go seize the stuff. If you read Agent Labneau's testimony, he explains why he continued to press him. And, in fact, Judge Zagel addresses that on the street, it is not always the first thing that comes out of a criminal defendant's mouth that is the true one. And if you continue to press them, you sometimes get different stories. At some point in time, you write down what he said and put it in the warrant. And Agent Labneau testified that it was accurate as of the time
but
that it was written.
Every single version is relevant Brady material for trial, right?
Agreed.
And for evaluating the credibility, the fact that you have to pull it out.
It would be Brady, it would be Giglio, and it's 3500 material as to Bell, mm-hmm. which, of course, when we got to trial, was all disclosed. And that's it.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Brindley, I'll give you 1 minute.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. To address the point about Officer Corbis's motive and he wouldn't have a motive to do it this way, in a lot of ways it doesn't matter. We know that what Officer Corbis did illustrates reckless disregard for the truth. there is a motive. If you leave out strategically all the things that undermine Bell, that suggests there is a motive behind this. And the fact that they had better evidence and they didn't present it, just as in Davis, that doesn't help them. The other thing that I would address, they said that Mr. Shakespeare indicated that Bell signed the affidavit in the presence of the judge. There's no evidence in the record that that's when it was signed. Bell says he signed it at some point, if you look back to the record, but he doesn't know what it was. He didn't read it. And that's what we know about it. And ultimately, when you put this together, I think there is definitely, as a matter of logic, reckless disregard from the truth for Corbis that infects everything contained in this first-person account that he's saying he heard that he didn't actually hear. And as a result of that, that has to be stricken. There's not enough left for probable cause.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel will take the case under advisement, and I'll call.